Hello. Today we're going to continue our series looking at Jesus' parables. And today's parable is pretty short, so I'm going to read it myself in a second. But it goes right to the heart of what are our motivations in life? What's our self-image? And it's all wrapped up, as I say, in a very short story, which Jesus ends with a very punchy end too. So I'm going to read that in a second, but just to give you context, Jesus was with his disciples. He was with a crowd of people as well, and some of his teaching he exclusively gave to his disciples, and some of it seems to have been for the crowd. This particular bit of teaching, this particular story, was told for the benefit of those who were in the crowd, we're told, who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everybody else. And we're given a hint as to whom that might be within the story. But actually, this story isn't just for that crowd. It's for us too. And actually, it's a really sobering story, and we should be listening very hard to it. It involves two characters who are doing exactly the same thing. They were going to the temple to pray, but their thoughts and their body language, everything about them, were very different. And so was the outcome of their trip to the temple. So as I read it, watch out for those differences. The parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. To some who were confident in their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, "God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get." But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." So the first character we meet in this story is a Pharisee. And we've lost a little bit of perspective on what that means, because with our historic vantage point, we kind of see Pharisees as villains. Because we kind of know the story of the New Testament. But actually at the time, Pharisees were seen as spiritual leaders. They were morally very rigorous. They were at the center of the community, particularly the worship community, and they were respected in their community. This was a time of occupation, of subjugation by the Romans, when the religious life of the nation could possibly veer wildly off course. And these were men who stood out for preserving the nation's religious life by actively exhorting the nation to keep holy. Not a bad thing, you'd think, really. And their attempts to emphasize holiness meant that they went well beyond expectation in doing right things. So there's some examples given in this story. Instead of fasting twice a year, as good Jews were meant to do, they did it twice a week. And instead of just applying tithing to their money, they applied it to every aspect of their life religiously. So the Pharisee, he goes up to the front of the temple with his prayer, and the first words start pretty well, actually. "God, I thank you." But then it's not so good. It turns out the prayer is all about self-congratulating himself. It turns out to be less about God, more about self-talk. He's proving it's possible to pray to yourself. I rather liked this quote. Oh, no, that's the wrong one altogether. There we go. Have you ever met people like this? People who... This is a quote actually from a Bette Midler film, but I'm sure we've all met people like this who can only talk about themselves and have very little interest in you. Well, the Pharisee does the same. He speaks to God, but actually he's only got eyes for himself. He may well see that he's imperfect. I think probably Pharisees knew they were imperfect, but he's confident. He's totally confident he's doing well. And that opinion is bolstered by the fact that he compares with others, particularly with the other character in this story. So the other character is a tax collector. Now again, in 21st century UK, we've lost a little bit of perspective on Jesus using the example of a tax collector. At RBC, we used to have people working for the Inland Revenue in Nottingham, and I can tell you, they were good, upstanding people. But the historical position of a tax collector in the Roman Empire was very different indeed. As the Romans conquered the nations around them, they essentially leached out the wealth from those countries back to Rome. They used it to pay for the Roman armies. They used it to subsidize grain in Rome itself. And they did it by appointing local people. It's a smart move, actually, but they use local people who they use to extract the tax from the conquered people. And the payback to the tax collector themselves was that the Romans looked the other way if the tax collector skimmed wealth off for himself. So a tax collector was not just a normal person. They were a collaborator with the enemy. They were funding the occupation force. They were adding to the wealth of the oppressors, and they were cheating their own people for their own benefit. To become a tax collector, you have actively compromised yourself for the sake of personal wealth. You would have absolutely no doubt that you were hated by those around you and seen as the lowest of the low in terms of social respectability. But in this story, the tax collector could hardly pray at all. He hung back in the shadows. He was so distraught he beat his chest and begged for God's mercy. And the twist in the story is that the confident religious leader who stands up for holiness is not justified before God. The broken, sinful collaborator is. So you've heard the story. Question: which character do you see yourself as? Have a think. Do you see yourself as the Pharisee or the tax collector? Perhaps a bit of both or neither. Ironically, if you see yourself as the tax collector, then that's the most Pharisee-ish thing you could possibly do. It's easy to convince ourselves that actually that Pharisee's not us. We'd like to think in this story that we are the tax collector, but we have so much more Pharisee in us than we would dare to imagine. So let's have a think about what the Pharisee did wrong in this story. First of all, let me say there's no evidence that the Pharisee was boasting to anyone around him. We do hear of other stories in the New Testament where Pharisees are showing off just how wonderful they are, but not in this case. What we're privy to is his internal thought process here. So he's not actually showing a sort of fabricated humility, as we see sometimes for the Pharisees. What we're seeing is directly into his brain. And he's thinking about how he compares to the general population of Israel, and particularly characters like the tax collector. And the self-analysis he's doing says, actually, I'm doing all right. In fact, I could be a bit of an overachiever. And he's got confidence that he's justified because he doesn't do bad stuff and he does plenty of good stuff. The Pharisee's prayer gives glory to himself, neglects his need for forgiveness, and uses his prayer to look down on others. So two problems here. Self-confidence is based on what he does and doesn't do. And second, his judgment is based on self-comparison with others. In the case of the tax collector, he already knew he was at the bottom in terms of social respectability. He was marginalised in society. He didn't look up to anyone. Didn't look down on anyone because he was already on the bottom step. You couldn't get any lower. In the words of St. Paul about himself in the book of Timothy, he thinks, I'm the worst sinner. Ironically, that's a great place to be. The twist here is that Jesus turns the story and our expectation upside down by implying being a sinner and knowing you're a sinner is the best place you can be to be justified. To know you're broken and sinful is the very entrance gate to forgiveness and justification. This is something Jesus actually said earlier on in the Sermon on the Mount when he said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." So a couple of themes in this story about self-confidence and where does it come from, and also comparing yourselves with others is a good yardstick. So self-confidence, this is a definition I found on the internet. The self-confidence is the faith in one's own abilities and judgment, crucial for taking positive risks and pursuing goals. There's been a movement sweeping through Western culture over the past 50 years with parents and teachers alike agreeing the idea that improving children's self-confidence leads to improved performance and a more successful life outcome in general. And for adults, self-confidence is a building block in the road towards personal well-being. So, do you lack self-confidence, or are you full of it? Self-confidence can quite often be a function of your past, whether you were encouraged as a child, or in your school life, or in other areas of your life. Were you receiving positive comment? Did you receive messages that you're a star that's going to go far? Or did you hear messages that you're a loser, you'll go nowhere? Those kind of messages can become very ingrained in our lives. Our internal monologues can repeat them to ourselves, can repeat them to ourselves for our benefit or detriment. We have to be really careful the way we speak to people to reinforce or not messages, bad messages. But in many circumstances, self-confidence can be a force for good in your life, and without it, there are repercussions on mental health, relationships, and resilience. So what's wrong with the self-confidence that the Pharisee's showing? We're told the parable is addressing people who are self-confident, confident in their own righteousness. This is a bit confusing, and it's important to draw a distinction between self-confidence and spiritual self-confidence. Because actually, in the Bible, we are told to have confidence. In James 1, it says about confidence in prayer. It says, when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. This person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded, unstable in all they do. So actually, it's important to have confidence in God, and actually, that's important too. But there's a shadow side to self-confidence when it applies to our spiritual life. It can so easily tip into our internal monologue, telling us what we have done or what we haven't done is the defining factor or just a good reason why God loves us. And conversely, if our self-confidence becomes punctured by our inability to be anything except broken, then our internal monologue may be telling us what we have done or haven't done is the defining factor as to why God judges us and rejects us. Both versions are a lie. The Bible tells us God loves us. Jesus thinks we were worth dying for. Our justification and forgiveness, our saving from brokenness, that is a gift from God, and it's nothing to do with what we've done. I'm a dad for 5 lads, as most of you know, and I love my boys, and I absolutely always will. But sometimes they take poor decisions, and when they do, I'm generally a little bit sad, a little bit upset, but I try and dig them out from the bad decisions as best as I can, and my love doesn't end. So how much better is God a father to us? So in the Pharisee's case, it's still right to believe the right things, to strive to do what's right, not to be a robber, not to be an evildoer, not to steal someone else's wife or husband, but that's not what gives life. It's not your qualification or validation for the kingdom. That comes from God alone as a gift. And if you lean heavily on doing stuff or not doing stuff, then your eye naturally comes back to yourself rather than to God. I was listening to a talk about, it was a chap in America who was feeding back on some evangelistic research that had been done there. And they asked a whole load of people, if they died tonight, would they go to heaven and why? And this was a little time ago, so I don't know if it would be different now, but it was a very high percentage thought, yes, I will be, I'm confident I'm going to heaven. But 90% of them followed it up with something like, I've generally led a good life and I've done good things, or a version of that. The lie is we think our eternal destiny is based on how well we do. So let's spot where self-confidence has infiltrated our lives in a negative way and ask for God's forgiveness and lean on God's love. What about at RBC? How can spiritual self-confidence creep up on us? Here's some questions. Are we at most danger when we've done something we've already seen to work successfully? Is our natural inclination to believe that we're a talented bunch and we know how to do this? Do we have unhealthy pride in the stuff we do or don't do? This is a quote from one of the Desert Fathers. The closer a man comes to God, the more he sees himself as a sinner. I think I can see the truth in that, but I can also see the opposite as well. If you've been a Christian a long time, and a lot of us have, and you've been involved in church a long time, and a lot of us have, is there a loss of awareness of our brokenness, a tendency to forget what it was like to live without Christ in our life, for God's forgiveness to become rather mundane? Because those are the ingredients for spiritual self-confidence to breed. God, save us as a church from that. Let's lean into our brokenness and thank God for his love for us and for our community. The other unhelpful thing the Pharisee does is to spend time comparing to others around him to validate himself. And this is a very human thing to do. Many contexts, making a benchmark comparison can be a very useful thing. Most of you know I play a lot of paddle tennis, and the way I help myself is I look at my grade, because you can grade yourself in paddle, and you can compare that against the people you play against, and that can help you then to measure and benchmark yourself against other people, and you work out how you can improve as you see better players play. So it helps him spur us on and improve us. However, in this case, comparison with others is done in a judgmental and negative way. Your spiritual life isn't a game. It's not a comparison game where it matters where you are against somebody else. I think we all know that. But focusing on that will naturally end up with pride about your position. Or, on the other side, if you compare badly, envy, or beating yourself up because you judge yourself to be worse than somebody else. Jesus put it rather wittily, I think, when he said, "Why do you notice the splinter in your brother's eye, but do not perceive the wooden beam in your own eye? Remove the wooden beam from your eye first, then you will see clearly to remove the splinter from your brother's eye." So if we honestly see ourselves in relation to God and recognize our own brokenness, it's much easier to love broken people around us. If you find yourself struggling to not to judge someone else, then a good trick is to remind yourself that this person you're struggling with is someone God thought was worth saving. They have unsurpassable worth. And our job is not to judge them, it's to interact with them in a gracious way. When feelings of judgment come, train yourself to see those around you as having unsurpassable worth. Take your thoughts captive. It's a habit worth doing. So let's take care to avoid being judgmental of others and using that to judge, to justify ourselves. When Jesus was asked what's the greatest commandment, the answer was about loving God and our neighbour as ourselves. And our natural human condition, despite any best endeavours, is to love sin and not God, to love ourselves more than we love others. It's impossible to permanently change that. As Paul says, "I do not understand what I do, for what I do I do not want to do, but what I hate I do. I have the desire to do what's good, but I cannot carry it out, for I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do. This I keep on doing." So our options are to hide our sinful nature from ourselves or attempt to cover it up with good actions like the Pharisee, or to accept it and fall on God's mercy like the tax collector. And the only way to find that forgiveness is through Jesus on the cross. And we need to be constantly pulled back to that. Communion is a great way of doing that, which we're going to do in just a couple of moments. So Jesus' warning at the end of the story is much more pithy than my sermon. I've gone too far. So he summed it up in one sentence. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. So this parable has allowed us to get into the heads of these two characters. But only you can actually get in your own head and self-reflect. Is your self-confidence based on what you do and don't do? And whether it's directly or subtly, do you judge yourself, judge others to elevate yourself? When none of us are here to beat ourselves up, and actually that's a really unhelpful thing. This kind of talk is not about convincing you you're a loser or unlovable, quite the opposite. We're loved. Jesus thought that broken people were worth dying for. Jesus came to save those that need saving and know they need it. He welcomes us into his kingdom. And it turns out that our brokenness is the admission price into that kingdom. Amen.